Also from Exodus chapter 15, verses 20 to 21. Miriam, the sister of Aaron, was a prophet. So she took her tambourine and led the other women out to play their tambourines and to dance. Then she sang to them, "Sing praises to Yahweh for the great victory. Yahweh has thrown the horses and their riders into the sea."
For 2017, we are romping through the Bible, cover to cover, and we've made it already to the second book. 64 more to go, plus some extras, including the Apocrypha, and some books that didn't quite make it into the Bible at all. But we'll get through them. Today is the book of Exodus. My mother was a high priestess. My father I knew not. The brothers of my father loved the hills. My city is Azuparanu, which is situated on the banks of the Euphrates. My high priestess mother conceived me. In secret, she bore me. She set me in a basket of rushes. With bitumen, she sealed my lid. She cast me into the river, which rose over me. The river bore me up and carried me to Aki, the drawer of water. Aki, the drawer of water, took me as his son and reared me. Aki, the drawer of water, appointed me as his gardener. While I was a gardener, Ishtar granted me her love, and for 4 years I exercised kingship. That's the legend of the birth of Sargon the Great, the Assyrian king. And this legend was found in the library of Ashur Banipal in Nineveh, Assyria, which is near Mosul in modern-day Iraq, along with thousands of clay tablets from the 8th and 7th centuries BC. The Epic of Gilgamesh is also housed in this collection. The library was discovered through archaeology in 1849, and most of the collection was taken to England, and it sits in the British Museum. The birth of baby Moses, also born in secret, placed in a basket of rushes sealed by bitumen, set adrift in the river, discovered and raised by Pharaoh's house, has enchanting parallels with the birth of Sargon. Even the detail of the names, Moses and Aki, both mean drawing out. These storytellers who drafted the stories of the Bible had a rich store of legends and myths to draw upon as they created the saga of the Hebrew people. So we find many parallels in the Bible with the myths and legends of the ancient Near East. The Enuma Elish is the creation account repeated and retold in Genesis chapter 1. The Epic of Gilgamesh and Noah's Flood. The Sumerian story of the shepherd and the farmer parallels Cain and Abel. And the birth stories of Sargon and Moses. And one story builds on another. Baby Moses is also the precursor for baby Jesus in the Gospel of Matthew. In the Jesus story, Herod is the new Pharaoh who wants all the baby boys killed, but divine providence thwarts Herod's and Pharaoh's evil plans, and our heroes, Moses and Jesus, are born instead and save the people. Knowing the parallels keeps us from falling into a trap of thinking the biblical stories were actual events on one hand, that they are narrative creations, but even more interesting is how the biblical storytellers took these various myths at their disposal and shaped them into telling their own story. And I think that's a task for all of us today. We aren't imprisoned by the myths of old, but they are resources from which to draw and create our own. So the understanding of the Bible has changed a lot in really just 100 years. It used to be understood that the Bible was the story of creation, human origins, and history, and was accurate unless proven wrong. Now it's seen by scholarship as having little or no connection to actual events. There's no outside affirmation of biblical events or characters through archaeology or other texts until we get to Solomon, and that's pretty sparse. It doesn't mean it's all fiction, that none of it happened. It's just that the burden of proof has shifted. And that means churches and synagogues have the task of reflection on how these stories are to be approached and valued and used. The Bible is not authoritative because it's historically accurate or objectively true. If it is to have authority, that authority must come from somewhere else, and that somewhere else is us. It's up to us to make the decision as to how or why the Bible will have value to us. I personally have found this liberating. The Bible is what it is. And in many ways, it's barbaric. The God it depicts, Yahweh, can be a nightmare. I'm happy Yahweh didn't choose me to make a deal. Yet, at the same time, there is a resonance between the Bible's longings and its frustrations and ours. And liberation is the theme for today. We last left our tribe in Egypt with Jacob, his daughter Dinah, his 12 sons, and 70 grandchildren. And they're doing just fine until they took literally the command by Yahweh to be fruitful and multiply. And they became so fruitful that they were considered a demographic threat by the Egyptians. The Egyptians feared that the Hebrews would become so numerous that they would shift the balance of power and ally with Egypt's enemies. And Pharaoh did what all paranoid leaders of regimes do. He initiated a first strike, and he enslaved and oppressed the Hebrews. They were forced to make bricks and build the great Egyptian cities. Surprisingly, the harder they were oppressed, the more children they had. So Pharaoh called in the midwives, the call of the midwives, Shipra and Puah, and told them to kill the male babies. And that didn't sit well with Shipra and Puah, so they engaged in what we now call civil disobedience. They did the shuck and jive. They didn't do what Pharaoh required, and then they lied to him. The Hebrew women have babies too darn fast. They just pop them out before we get there. Yahweh liked the midwives, and he opened their wombs so they had many children of their own. Blessed be the fruit. Pharaoh initiates Plan B. Send out the riot cops, go house to house, and drown all the babies in the Nile. The Hebrews have to hide their babies if they're going to survive. And so one couple hides her baby in a basket covered with pitch and floats him in the Nile. His older sister, Miriam, watches. Pharaoh's daughter finds him, and his quick-thinking sister says, "Hey, I know of a nursemaid. She's exactly what you need." So his sister gets her mother, and she comes to Pharaoh's house to nurse her own son on behalf of Pharaoh's daughter. Pharaoh's daughter gives him an Egyptian name, Moses, which means draw out, because she drew him out of the water. Moses grows up in Pharaoh's house. One day he sees an Egyptian beating a Hebrew slave, and Moses kills the Egyptian. And then he realizes, what side am I on? He has to run away, and he settles in Midian, and there he finds a bride. Enter Yahweh. Yahweh hears the cries of the enslaved Hebrews, and he confronts Moses in a bush that is on fire but not consumed. Yahweh tells Moses that he will liberate the Hebrew people, and Moses is going to make it happen. Well, Moses goes back to Egypt with his brother Aaron, and they confront Pharaoh. Remember, let my people go. But Yahweh hardens Pharaoh's heart. And this is a troubling notion for us modern readers. Yahweh causes Pharaoh to say no, so that Yahweh can send in all kinds of plagues, bloody rivers, frogs, gnats, dead animals, darkness, lice, boils. And finally, the death of the firstborn son of not only all humans, but the firstborn male of animals too. Why? Because Yahweh wants the world to know that Yahweh is boss. Everyone will remember Yahweh's name. So Pharaoh does say no every time a plague happens until the last plague, the death of his son. The Hebrew people were saved from this, from the angel of death, from Pharaoh's fate, because they put blood on their doorposts. And so they escape Egypt with a lot of booty and make it to Yam Suf, translated Red Sea. And Yahweh, to make things even more interesting, again hardens Pharaoh's heart, so Pharaoh sends out the troops. And at the last second, everybody knows this from Charlton Heston's movie, Yahweh makes a miraculous crossing of the sea for the Hebrew people. Pharaoh's army is drowned. Payback for Pharaoh's drowning of the Hebrew babies. Moses' sister Miriam leads the women with their tambourines to dance, sing praises to Yahweh for Yahweh's great victory. Yahweh has thrown the horses and their riders into the sea. And that is the central text of the Torah, the dance of liberation. Yahweh takes sides. The story has provided the spiritual energy for the survival of oppressed people and for many liberation movements throughout history, including surviving the terror and the aftermath of American slavery to this day. This liberation saga is the meaning of Passover, or the festival of thin bread that is celebrated by Jews today. It's the most important commemoration for Jews. It is also the basis for the Jesus saga, the death and resurrection stories of Jesus. A story set at Passover can be seen as an expansion of the story of liberation. Both stories are the promises from bondage to freedom, from death to life, from despair to hope, and the victory of the people over the tyranny of empire. And while these stories are told in the style of miracle and of legend, they are nonetheless, in my opinion, true, in that they tell the truth about the reality of oppression and the promise of liberation, a promise that must not only be trusted, but enacted. Shiprah and Puah represent courageous and cagey civil disobedience. Some laws need to be disobeyed. The hardening of Pharaoh's heart, regardless of Yahweh's role in it, tells the truth that oppressors never, ever give up power voluntarily. You cannot simply request liberation and think it might be granted. It must be taken. Resistance must be persistent. And you have to have the stomach for it. As the plagues increased on Pharaoh, so Pharaoh increased his oppression of the Hebrews. They had to make the same number of bricks without straw. The violence increased. And the Hebrews complained to Moses that he should just leave them alone. Don't rock the boat. Don't be an outside agitator. Liberation is costly. And we must ask ourselves always, are we willing to pay the cost? Or will we simply say, well, it's just too much work. It doesn't matter that much. Or the oppression really isn't all that bad. And even after liberation, the Hebrew people complained to Moses that at least they had food in Egypt. We're going to starve out here in the desert, they say. So liberation is only the first part of the story. The hard part at times is learning how to live with new freedom, new agency, new choices that are ours to make and not made for us. Those are just a couple of lessons I pick up by reading this story. The rest of Exodus is about another covenant, the Moses covenant, or the Mosaic covenant. And the Hebrews are led by Yahweh to Mount Sinai, also called Mount Horeb, depending on which author is writing. And while at the mountain, Yahweh delivers the rules to the people in person. They have to stay at the foot, and there's big thunder and rumbling at the top. Yahweh booms it out. Then over the course of several chapters, Yahweh writes them on two flat stone tablets for Moses to bring to the people. And the major commandment is no other deity but Yahweh. Yahweh definitely does not share. Yahweh always wants credit. Then there's the story of the golden calf. Neither Yahweh or Moses is pleased about that. A lot of killing, a lot of disease and death results from that. And again, let this be a lesson. Don't be messing with Yahweh by flirting with other gods or their symbols. So the covenant that's made with the people through Moses is particular and conditional. The Ten Commandments isn't for everybody. The Ten Commandments and the other rules were for a particular people, the Hebrew people. And it's conditioned on the people's obedience. The promise is that Yahweh will protect the people, give them land, and defeat their enemies for them if they obey. But if not, then Yahweh will let their enemies destroy them. And there's a lot to obey. But the primary commandment is no other gods. And this will be the thread throughout the rest of the saga of the Hebrew Scriptures. And of course, there are other rules that was given by Yahweh. Keep the Sabbath day, keep three festivals, the Passover, Pentecost, and the Harvest Festival. There are justice issues regarding murder and property stealing and how to do that, as well as, ironically, how to treat slaves. There will be more to come when we get to Leviticus, but these laws in Exodus were inscribed on these tablets. So here's a question. Well, where do we put the tablets? Well, Yahweh has a plan. You build this big box for the tablets, and you carry the box with these poles. And you make some other impressive stuff, too, like a 75-pound golden menorah. Add a bronze bowl and a table for sacrifices. You make a big fancy tent with pricey materials. You make cool robes for Aaron and has little pomegranates and bells dangle from them so when he goes into the temple, Yahweh can hear him. And in the end, a nice yet expensive portable tiny house for Yahweh. You know, it's really fun reading these stories of Yahweh. At once, the creator of the universe, you know, God, a very God, light, a very light, beyond all, and all that kind of stuff. And then, who knows everything. And then on the other hand, a jealous old man who likes to smell cooked meat and be surrounded by nice things. Well, finally, they get it done. And they do a good job. The people contribute, here's a stewardship lesson, the people contribute more than what was needed for the task. Definitely learning their lesson from the golden calf incident. And Yahweh is happy, because if Yahweh ain't happy, nobody's happy. The book of Exodus ends with Yahweh entering the tent. And you know that because his presence is signified by a cloud. Moses hangs out there in the tent with him, and Yahweh gives him more rules to deliver to the people. Moses is the middleman. And when it's time to move, the cloud leaves the tent, and everyone packs up with the ark and all the stuff and follows the cloud. So the book of Exodus ends as Genesis begins. Yahweh is finally intimate and close with those who he has created in his image. Once Yahweh walked with Adam and Eve in the garden in the cool of the day. Now Yahweh lives among them in his tent and personally leads them to the land of promise. When we read the story of the Torah and the rest of the Bible, we've been taught, at least I was taught, that Yahweh's always right. And the people in the Bible are always wrong. You can always explain it that way. And since I grew up in church, that was how the story was presented. No matter what Yahweh or God does, Yahweh or God is always right. Do we read the story that way still? I like the story of liberation. I like the story of how after liberation, the people have to figure out who they are and how they're going to live together. Yahweh, personally, not so much. Is the story really about Yahweh? Or is Yahweh an extra, perhaps a necessary extra at the time, but now not so much? If Yahweh fades like the smile on the Cheshire Cat in Alice in Wonderland, what might replace Yahweh as we create our own saga of who we are and where we are going? I'll leave that there until next week. Meanwhile, I'll dance with Miriam.